61, there's no one signed up, but we do have a letter from Bullivant, Hauser, and Bailey addressing this issue. And, Council, do you want to give us a chance for what this bill does?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2761 in its current form fixes a technical problem with the rules of civil procedure that appear to, if you look at the current rules of civil procedure, it looks as if in a post-judgment situation, and I know this is kind of a lawyer's bill, but if you make a motion against the judgment and that motion is ruled upon before final judgment is entered, it looks like you have to appeal the entire case within 30 days of the order coming down, not 30 days of the final judgment. And it's always obviously been the intent that the appeal runs from 30 days from the entry of the final judgment. And so that's the fix. That's the first part of House Bill 2761. Then the second part you'll see, and that's just a technical fix. It's just a confusion in the language.
Okay.
Then the second part of 2761 is the A2 amendments. And what the A2 amendments do is they add they amend Oregon law to create an additional procedural requirement when you're trying to enforce a foreign judgment in the state of Oregon. And foreign doesn't necessarily mean foreign country. It could be, but typically it does. This would add reciprocity so that if the country that you're trying, if the country from which the judgment is coming from does not enforce judgments of the United States, then you could not enforce a judgment from that country in this country. And what that means is it gives reciprocity so that, let's say, for instance, a foreign country like Singapore does not, and I'm just pulling this as an example, does not recognize judgments in the United States, and we had a judgment here and the defendant was in Singapore and we were unable to execute that judgment there and garnish that person's wages or take certain property. If that person or another person of Singapore goes to a Singapore court, gets a judgment, and tries to execute in the United States, the state of Oregon would not recognize that judgment. And hopefully we're encouraging Singapore, in this case, to recognize our judgment so that they could have the same recognition here. It's just simple reciprocity. Understand this is a law that many other states already have, but Oregon does not have that. And that's what the -A2 amendments do.
All right. Any questions on discussion? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Bill, I'd just be curious as to generally, do most other countries allow reciprocity? I'm not familiar with that at all, so I'm just curious.
Yeah, in most countries do and allow reciprocity, at least most of the Western countries. Mm-hmm. And there is a process by which you execute a foreign judgment. Usually, it's quite similar to executing a judgment in another state. You have to go to that country's court. You essentially hire local counsel. They take the judgment that we have from the United States and turn it into a judgment of that foreign country, and then you execute the judgment from the foreign country. Here, this would just be adding a requirement that you make a showing in Oregon that the foreign country would recognize an Oregon judgment. But it's my understanding that most states that are, you know, the Western European states and most other modern industrial states do recognize foreign judgments. This is just making sure that if they don't, that they don't somehow have an unfair advantage by being able to execute judgments in Oregon where we couldn't do so in return. One of the things is that defense, if you file a counterclaim in an action where you're trying to defend against a foreign judgment being enforced in Oregon, and you actually win and you get a judgment, even though that's in the same suit, you may not necessarily be able to then use that judgment against the same party back in their country. So they would essentially have a shield, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Everybody okay? Let's do a little work session. 2761, Senator whomever.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
2761 seems like a very fine measure to me.
Would you move the A2 amendment, please?
I hereby move the A2 amendment.
Senator Farioli moves that we adopt the A2 amendment to House Bill 2761. Any discussion? Any objection? Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman, I further move House Bill 2761 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli now moves House Bill 2761 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Burdick, this is mostly a technical bill dealing with some timelines and filings of various appeals, I believe, and also provides for reciprocity and enforcement of certain judgments that are foreign.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thought I was moving a expansion of the multinational international capitalist plot, but
Mr. Chairman,
no more discussion.
If Mr. Farioli is moving it, then I know it must be good.
It's a good bill,
All right.
Vice Chairman.
Great. Thank you. Any other discussion? If there's not, no objection. Motion passes, and I'll carry this thing. Okay. There we go. Now what's up for us? We got some other exciting stuff here, don't we, today?
We do.
After 18.
Do you want to start at the top of the list, 2057?
The great relief.
Yeah, let's do that. 57. Let's do a public hearing on 2057. Let me see if I can whip through some of the other stuff before we get into the other fun stuff. Why am I not finding this? I've got them all confused. Oh, there we go. Got to be able to read. George Reimer? Is that right?
Yes, Reimer.
I always do that. It's a Reimer, it's minus, minus, whatever. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is George Reimer. I'm General Counsel of the Oregon State Bar. This bill has four components. The first component would be to allow the bar to conduct electronic elections for the Board of Governors and our House of Delegates. Currently, we conduct elections by mail ballot, and in the computer age, we're thinking of moving to a perhaps more efficient and cost-effective process. The second component deals with situations where we may have only one candidate for a position, and under this proposed statutory change, that candidate would then be deemed elected. The third component is really just a minor tweak in the statutes. We already waive bar dues for members of the bar who have been admitted in Oregon 50 years or more. This would allow us to basically waive another component of bar dues for those folks to be consistent that we can waive all the fees that might be applicable to them. The last item has to do with the Supreme Court's review of disciplinary cases. Under current law, if a lawyer is reprimanded or suspended up to 6 months, either the lawyer or the bar can appeal the case to the Supreme Court, and if it is appealed, the court is required to review it. If the lawyer is suspended for more than 6 months or up to including disbarment, the case is automatically reviewed by the Supreme Court. Under this change, the appeal process would be either the bar or the accused lawyer could ask the court to review it. Absent such a review, the decision of the trial panel of the disciplinary board would be final. We've broached this topic with the Supreme Court. They're supportive of a change in their rules if this statute passes. And the net effect of the change would likely be fewer cases in this category being considered by the court. So that might reduce somewhat their caseload. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions of Mr. Reimer? There are no questions. And that's pretty much it. There's no one else signed up. We'll do a little work session on House Bill 2057.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2057 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2057 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation unamended.
Second.
Sir? Yeah, would you like to include in your motion a consent calendar or not?
Yeah, sure.
And include this on the consent calendar.
I think we're the only committee that's even using that, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we're the only most we're the only efficient committee anyway.
This is true, Mr. Chairman.
Anyway.
Glad you pointed that out.
Everybody understand the motion? Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? No objection to the motion. Passes. And Senator Ringo, since you are the only member of the bar on the committee, if you would carry this, I would at least signal that lawyers like it.
That would be fun.
All right. Thank you very much. Next up. Well, this looks like an exciting one here. 2059. We'll do a public hearing here.
This is kind of, you guys been seeing that all session.
All right. This is my next victim. Oh,
good
came up
good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Linda Johansson. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Debtor Creditor Section. House Bill 2059A sets a procedure for parties who've had their vehicles towed and want to dispute the amount of the tow charges to post a bond and get their vehicle back, which eliminates ongoing storage charges while they're disputing the charges. We have set the minimum amount that has to be in dispute at $750, and then the person posting the bond would have to double that amount, so 200% of whatever's in dispute, in order to protect the towing company for any costs involved in this.
All right. There's no one signed up in opposition to this. Council, you want to?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, we do have two amendments on this one. The reason for the amendment is just that there's an arithmetic error in the current bill. If you look in the bill, it requires a posting of, talk off the top of my head here, I think 200%, and it's got to be at least $750. And I don't know, somehow if you do the math, and that's why I went to law school, because I'm not very good at math, but you get the wrong number. So what they're doing is they're just removing the whichever, or the or $1,000, whichever is greater language. And so that fixes the arithmetic error, as I understand it. And maybe somebody with a calculator can verify, but that's my understanding of the A2 amendments, and they came out of LC.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think, and I'm not a mathematician either, but it looks to me like 200% of 750 costs, well, 1,000 would never be greater.
Right.
So that's probably what they're taking out.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Let's do a little work session on this puppy. It seems innocuous enough.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brink.
I move the -A2 amendments to House Bill 2059 be adopted.
Senator Burdick moves the A2 amendment to House Bill 2059. And that seems reasonable because we don't want to look like idiots, right? Okay. Which we're actually pretty good at.
A bad mathematician.
That's why we became politicians, for God's sake.
It had already made it to the House on my watch with that error in there.
2 + 2 means whatever we want it to be, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Any additional discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? There is no objection. Motion passes.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2059A as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation on the consent calendar.
All right. Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2059 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. And
yeah,
before we move, I might not because I think
we Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman, could I revise my motion to put on the regular calendar?
Senator Burdick withdraws her motion, the original
and
motion, and now
states
a new motion.
To move House Bill 2059A as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Burdick now moves House Bill 2059 as amended by this committee to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
For one.
Any discussion? Any objections? There are no objections. Motion passes. And Senator Starr, would you be kind enough
gladly
handle that for us?
Yeah. Thank you.
All righty. We're cooking with gas now, aren't we? Let's see. All right. 2060. Public hearing. Linda's back. You've done such a fine job so far.
Thank you, Senator. Again, my name is Linda Johansson, and I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland here on behalf of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar. House Bill 2060A is kind of a consumer protection bill to allow homeowners and junior lien holders to request information from a trustee during a non-judicial foreclosure so that they know the amounts necessary to either cure the defaults or pay off the loan prior to the sale. This has become an ongoing problem within the non-judicial foreclosure arena because of out-of-state trustee services who are non-responsive to homeowners and the other lien holders on the property. So we're just attempting to provide a provision or make a provision so that people can get the information and the trustee has to provide it or they can't go to sale.
All right. Any questions on the bill, or Mr. Hansen, or you want to spend some time reading this one? No? Okay. All right. Sounds like a good idea, providing information to people that might have an interest in it. I assume they're either going to, are they curing the lien or the?
Correct.
Okay.
And, of course, the statutes haven't given absolute right to the homeowner to cure the lien before a sale takes place.
Right.
But if they can't get the information, it's pretty difficult. So this should eliminate some unnecessary court filings to stop sales, and hopefully will also eliminate some unnecessary bankruptcies that are filed to stop sales.
Seems to make sense to me. No amendments to this bill? All right, let's do a work session. House Bill 2060.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2060 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2060 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? No objections. Well, passes. Senator Ferrioli, would you handle that one for us?
Well, sir.
Thank you. And 2150, public hearing. Rick Mills.
Good morning, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. My name is Rick Mills. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and we're here to ask your support in HB 2150A. Briefly, just a little background information. As you're well aware, the Department of Human Services has many public assistance programs. Some of those programs are required by state law and, in some cases, federal law to have what's known as an estate recovery component. In very simple terms, what that means is if the public assistance recipient is receiving the specific designated kinds of public assistance, when they pass away, a claim will be submitted to their estate for reimbursement of the services that were provided to that individual by the Department of Human Services. Our program currently generates almost $40 million in a biennium. 40% of that goes back to the federal government as part of their share on the Medicaid funds that they provided to us, and approximately 60% goes back into the DHS budget. And not surprisingly, many of our clients don't have a whole lot, and so when they do pass away, they can take advantage of an expedited, kind of cost-effective probate process known as a small estate affidavit. What that usually means is some family member will prepare a small estate affidavit and file it with the appropriate court. There is no direct court supervision of that process. What this bill does is it requests three changes to the small estate affidavit process, which would reduce administrative costs for the Department of Human Services in conducting its estate recovery program, and in some cases prevent the loss of revenue which we are legally currently entitled to receive. The first one, which is a very minor technical change, is that we request the statute, which currently says that a copy of every small estate affidavit be mailed or delivered to the Department of Human Services, be changed to say that it will go specifically to the Estate Administration Unit in the Department of Human Services. Unfortunately, practitioners get a little bit confused about where to send these small estate affidavits, and they kind of tend to get sent out to all sorts of unusual locations. I mean, I've had them get sent to child support enforcement, and then it takes weeks for them to work their way over to the appropriate unit. So that's why we're asking that its statute specifically list the state administration in the hopes of cutting down on those sort of misdirected mailings. The second thing that we're requesting is In some cases, the family will choose not to probate the deceased person's estate. Quite often that will happen when it turns out that our claim for reimbursement is going to exceed the amount of assets in the decedent's estate, and therefore they're not going to receive any inheritance, and so they have no motivation to file the small estate affidavit and probate the estate for the deceased. So we then can, or any creditor for that matter, can go in and file the small estate affidavit and probate the estate themselves. This allows us then, of course, to submit our claim and have it paid. One of the things is frequently when filing a small estate affidavit, you have to provide a certified copy of that affidavit to certain interested parties. Certified copy of an affidavit is not defined in the statute, and many parties interpret that to mean that it has to be a court-certified copy. That means, of course, that we have to go through a laborious administrative process of cutting a check for anywhere from $3 to $5, mailing it off to the court clerk, having the court clerk make a copy of the affidavit, certify it, mail it back to us, and that creates a lot of extra work for both us and for the court administrators. So therefore, we are asking, as the second amendment in this thing, that the Department of Human Services be allowed to certify its own copies of small estate affidavits that it files. That way we can cut down on a lot of extra administrative work for both us and the court. The third one is a little bit more technical. When a small estate affidavit is filed, people have a window on time in which to submit their claims to that estate. And if the affiant, the person who's handling that estate, fails to perform their duty, basically ignores those claims, doesn't dispute them, doesn't respond, doesn't pay them, or if they fail or refuse to pay shares of that estate out to appropriate designated devisees or heirs, the remedy available to the aggrieved parties is to file what's known as a petition for summary review with the court and basically ask the court to direct that affiant to perform their job and pay the claims and distribute the money to the appropriate heirs and devisees. The catch here is the statute specifies that a petition for summary review must be submitted within 2 years of the date of death. So, for example, John Smith dies on January 1, 2000. His son moves into the house and does nothing to probate the estate. On January 1, 2003, the son decides he wants to sell the house and discovers that he doesn't have title because it's still in the name of his deceased father. He goes down to the courthouse, files a small estate affidavit. We or any other creditor submits their claim. He ignores the claim. Because it's been more than 2 years after the date of death, we cannot petition the court for summary review. So basically, we don't have a remedy available to us. So what we've asked here is to change the statute to indicate that a party has 2 years from the date that the affidavit is filed to request or file their petition for summary review, rather than from 2 years from the date of death. And I can tell you that the department has lost money in some cases because of that particular provision. In closing, I would note that neither the Judicial Department nor the Elder Law Section of the Oregon Bar or the Estate Planning Section of the Oregon Bar have any objections to these changes that we've requested. That's all I've got to say, and I'd be certainly happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Another question. Counsel, with respect to the DSL bills, were we making any changes? We had some discussion, I think, about the time of death being the starting point for some of the issues in the DSL filings. I'm not sure if that's will be different or is the same issue or not. So
I don't recall, and we probably need Warren. I can find out, though.
Yeah.
We can hold this one.
Yeah, because I thought he was advocating something with respect to the beginning, the date of death, and had something with DSL's interest in the state also.
I do remember a discussion similar to that. I know that those have gone in 64 now and are not. The timing issues were compromised in Senate Bill 64, so but I'd have to check to make sure that these...
Anybody... Okay, well, we'll do that. We'll just check and see if we're not doing something different or in a different direction. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. What's the small estate amount, $30,000?
Chairman, it's Senator Ringo. Currently, a small estate affidavit, the person has to have $50,000 or less in personal property and or $90,000 or less in real property for it to be subject to a small estate affidavit.
And when the department, you said the department receives about $40 million a year?
It, for part of its estate recovery program, yes.
And could you just give an example of... Give a typical example of how you get the money in. Is it equity in somebody's house? Is it cash sitting in a bank? What is it?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, basically most of the funds that we receive is through one of two methods. An individual may have a bank account when they pass away, which will have generally has under $2,000, which is the resource limit for Medicaid. Under the banking statutes, if there's no surviving spouse, we have the statutory authority to contact the bank directly and request that they disperse those funds to us.
That's the stuff right there. Now, let's say that there was a surviving children. You're going to get the money ahead of the kids.
Chairman Senator Ringo, the children, the only time that our claim would be waived when there are children involved is if the child is under 21 years of age, the child is permanently and totally disabled as defined by Social Security Administration criteria, or the child is blind, in which case we would waive our claim.
I see. Now, if the child, if they were on a joint account, then you wouldn't get the money, right? It would just go to the joint account holder?
Senator Ringo, we don't have any statutory authority right now to go directly to the bank on joint accounts. That is a problem area for us, because the client is instructed when they come in and apply for assistance not to commingle their funds in an account with somebody else. So generally speaking, and in our experience in most cases with joint bank accounts, our experience is that it usually is just the client's money. But we have to contact the joint account holder and try to get them to disperse the monies to us rather than going straight to the financial institution.
With respect to equity in the house, will you order a home to be sold?
I'm sorry?
With respect to equity in a house, I think you said $90,000 is a real property fits in the small estate exemption.
Senator Ringo, small estate affidavit is the real property has to be valued at $90,000 or less.
The equity.
My understanding is that it's the value, the fair market value of the asset, not the equity. But anyway, back to that. When, generally speaking, usually the only major asset of one of our clients is what used to be their home. When they have a home, if the family wants to keep that home, we will usually work with them to try to figure out some way for them to retain that rather than have them be forced to sell it during the probate process in order to satisfy our claim. And we are willing to take a note and trust deed in those sorts of circumstances. There are some circumstances, particularly, there might be an instance, for instance, we've had cases where there was a disabled grandchild who was living in the house. And under the federal law, we can't automatically waive our claim if there is a disabled grandchild. We can only waive it for a disabled child. If we have a situation like that where there's a disabled grandchild, they can request a hardship waiver, or in some cases what we do is we take what we call an open-ended mortgage, which is basically what we do is We get a mortgage which is attached to that real property, and we say, look, you don't have to make any payments to us, but when you pass away or when the property is sold, then we need to sit down and look at whether our claim is going to be paid at that point in time.
Chair, follow up.
Yes, go ahead.
You mentioned there were a couple cases where people had waited 2 years before filing their affidavit. To your mind, did they wait in order to avoid the law, or did they just not have their act together?
Chairman, it's Senator Ringo. You know, I can't tell you. My assumption is that in most cases, what happens is many people just don't realize that they may be creating this sort of problem for themselves. It's just easy, you know. They're living in the house. It's like, you know, this is a lot of very confusing paperwork. You know, I'm going to have to go see a lawyer sort of thing. I can't tell you that, you know, some people wouldn't try to do that intentionally. I suppose there are some people that might try to play the system that way. But I can't tell you that I've done any investigations to try to, you know, identify what percentage would be one as opposed to the other sort of thing.
Let's say there's a delay in filing the affidavit. Does the department have any mechanism by which it can assert its lien on the value of the estate?
Chairman, as Senator Ringo, well, first of all, I'd like to clarify, we don't have a lien, and we never do.
Okay,
we just have a claim in a deceased estate, just like Sears, Roebuck, or the electric company.
So then I guess my question is, do you have any mechanism to assert your claim?
A creditor can always initiate the probate without the family's consent if they don't take action. What happens, though, is sometimes we don't know that there's an asset. See, if the client, by oversight or intention, fails to mention to us that they had the asset when they come in and apply for assistance, when they die, we don't know it's there. And so, obviously, we don't spend money filing a probate proceeding if we don't think there's anything for us to be paid. And then, lo and behold, you know, 2-3 years down the road, it turns out they had 100 shares of Intel stock or what have you, and somebody's filing a small estate affidavit. And it's a total surprise to us.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? There are none. I think we're going to hold this thing over and make sure we're not doing a couple of different things here. We've already sent out one bill dealing with DSL and has potentially some similar language in it for DSL.
No,
the DSL bill. Remember the Warren Darris issue?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's my first question, Mr. Chairman. What is Warren Darris supposed to do?
I don't know, but we'll probably find out.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mills.
So
appreciate it.
The rest of the bills are correct.
So we're going to close the public hearing. We're going to take a 5-minute recess.
Okay.
Senate Judiciary Committee back to order. We're going to do a public hearing on House Bill 2086. Okay, Kelly Peterson, Randy Covey, Jim Harper, Marsha Keith, it's Chief Jim Harper, and Lieutenant Randy Covey. You'll all come up and do your presentation. Who's first? You? All right, Kelly, introduce yourself and proceed, please.
Good morning, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm with the Humane Society of the United States, and we're here to offer testimony in support of House Bill 2086A. This bill, what it would do is it would elevate cockfighting to a Class C felony, and it would prohibit the raising and breeding of fighting birds with the intent to fight, which would mirror the dogfighting statutes. Just some background, 48 states have already outlawed cockfighting, and it's a felony offense in 28 states, and over 30 states have laws prohibiting the possession of fighting birds with the intent to fight. In fact, California is considering a bill, Senate Bill 732, which you have in your packet, which would increase the penalty to a felony offense, and that's in response to the outbreak of exotic Newcastle disease. I've also included in your packet a few articles giving an overview of the illegal cockfighting activities in Oregon, and I won't go through them. There's about 10 different articles that have been captured in the newspapers, but we believe these cases just provide a glimpse of organized cockfighting activities in Oregon. And quite honestly, as we know, cockfighting is an extreme case of animal cruelty, but it also involves a host of other illegal activities, such as illegal gambling, illegal drug possession, and firearm possession. Recently, also more background, President Bush signed into law the Farm Security Act, and that takes effect this month, actually May 1st. And what it does is it prohibits the interstate transport of fighting birds and the export of fighting birds. Again, this bill, what it does is it would closely mirror the Oregon dogfighting statutes, which are already in law. In Oregon, it's a felony to raise and breed and train fighting dogs, and it's also a misdemeanor to be a spectator at a dogfight. And federal law also already prohibits the transport and export of fighting dogs. And it's important to know, since these laws were enacted, there have been no negative consequences to breeders or to those individuals who show similar breeds like pit bulls. This change in the law is broadly supported by the public, editorial boards, and, of course, law enforcement. Again, you have a law enforcement endorsement sheet, and I won't review all of them, but you can see it includes the major law enforcement organizations in the state, as well as the editorial endorsements you have in your packet as well. And this bill has been massaged. It was narrowly crafted to affect only those people who are raising birds for fighting purposes. Last session, the House Judiciary Committee took extreme care to make sure that those engaging in cockfighting would only be affected by the bill. And those protections are included in this bill, House Bill 2086A. And there are, in Section 2, Subsection 1, states, you know, it talks about knowingly owning and possessing and keeping and rearing and training, buying, selling, or advertising, or otherwise offering to sell a fighting bird. And I won't read every section, but the additional section is Section 2, Subsection 2, that basically states you can own a bird for any other purpose other than trading the bird as a fighting bird, etc. And we feel clearly this language provides ample protection from prosecution for law-abiding growers and breeders and owners. And with that, I will turn it over to maybe
to whomever.
Marsha
Keith.
Me. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marsha Keith. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association to speak in support of House Bill 2086A. As Kelly's pointed out, current Oregon law does ban cockfighting, and in addition, the federal legislation, which takes effect today,
and was sponsored by Oregon Senators Gordon Smith and Ron Wyden, has outlawed the interstate commerce in fighting fowl. The only loophole left is the raising of game birds for this cruel and inhumane practice. And we agree with the sponsors of the bill that it's time to close this loophole. There isn't anything pretty about cockfighting, and veterinarians across the state urge you to support House Bill 2086A.
All right, thank you, Marcia. Who's next? Chief?
Thanks. Chair Menace, members of the committee, my name is Jim Harper. I'm the police chief of Dallas Police Department. I'm here as a representative of the Oregon Associations of Chiefs of Police. We obviously are in support of this particular legislation. I testified on this bill earlier on the House side, and I want to kind of assure this particular committee, as I did on the House side, that the process that law enforcement goes through in the investigation of any of these cases is based on probable cause. So sometimes there's a little bit of paranoia about our ability to investigate some of these things arbitrarily. I just want to assure the committee that we take all investigations very seriously, as we would in these cases. It's going to be based on probable cause, which is a high basis of fact that we would use to determine whether or not the law has been violated. Aside from that, this particular legislation makes a lot of sense, and it takes care of the loopholes, as Kelly has already talked about. It's good legislation, and it makes a lot of sense from the Chiefs Association and also from the Sheriff's Association. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Why don't we get the testimony of Mr. Covey, Lieutenant Covey, and then we'll
Chairman
start the questions.
Members of the committee, Lieutenant Randall Covey, Oregon Special Agent, employed by the Law Enforcement Division of the Oregon Humane Society, here testify in support of House Bill 2086, the gross version. Special agent for the state of Oregon, I've investigated allegations of cockfighting, qualified as an expert witness in the U.S. and Canada, and have assisted with the identification of paraphernalia seized by other law enforcement agencies in cockfighting investigations. I want to talk about cockfighting a little bit this morning. Currently in Oregon, animal fighting is a crime. Dog fighting is a felony. Animal fighting is intended to include all other forms of animal fighting. It's currently a misdemeanor. But it's still legal to raise and breed fighting birds in the state of Oregon. Cockfighting needs to be separated as its own crime. Cockfighting is a barbaric, bloody pitting of one bird against another for the purpose of allowing humans to watch and wager on the outcome. The birds are altered, they're dubbed and trimmed, their natural spurs are cut off, they're trained, and they're fitted with gaffs, slashers, and knives, and turned loose, often in a fight to the death. As Kelly mentioned, there are other crimes almost always found when cockfighting rings are investigated and paraphernalia is seized. Besides the cockfighting specific offenses, there are gambling offenses, racketeering, and operating establishments for gaming purposes offenses. There's unreported income or tax evasion associated with cockfighting, conspiracy, narcotics and controlled substances, illegal sales of alcoholic beverages, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, concealed weapons, disorderly conduct, in addition to Animal Welfare Act or animal fighting violations. Certainly not a victimless crime. I want to reiterate that there are juvenile crimes associated and contributing to the delinquency of a minor is often found in regards to alcohol and gambling issues. Current law doesn't recognize the significance of cockfighting paraphernalia in regards to gaffs and slashers. House Bill 2086 does. House Bill 2086 also allows for the legal ownership, buying, and selling of any bird, including birds that could be used in cockfighting, which should alleviate any concerns that legitimate poultry growers have in regards to this particular bill. House Bill 2086 requires that law enforcement officers and prosecutors prove beyond a reasonable doubt that any person accused of cockfighting actually knew or intended their actions to be criminal. I want to reiterate Chief Harper's testimony and support his statements that law enforcement is required and always takes a very active role in determining whether or not the allegations can be proved in the course of their investigation. House Bill 2086 also requires quick action to show probable cause within 24 hours of any seizure, and it protects bird owners' interests in the welfare of the birds by allowing them to continue providing care for their animals on site until the allegation is resolved. Again, this addresses the opponent's concerns that their livelihood would be interfered with in some way. Oregon already has a felony dogfighting law, as Kelly has pointed out, which does not interfere with the lawful ownership, breeding, buying, and selling of any dog. House Bill 2086 is a good bill. It's necessary. It protects lawful bird activities. It allows law enforcement appropriate tools to prosecute illegal acts associated with cockfighting. And it's for these reasons that the Oregon Humane Society supports House Bill 2086.
All right. Thank you. Any questions by the committee of the panel?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
You said that this protects lawful bird owning. If someone has a bird who happens to be of the same maybe genetic makeup as a cockfighting bird, that is protected if they're not using it for that purpose or intending to use them for that purpose. Could you direct me to the place, maybe Kelly could, in the bill that protects?
Actually, why don't we have council do that to make sure that we're all tracking, because,
okay.
And I'll do my little rudimentary attempt at this. The fighting bird definition seems to be key.
That's right.
Because it means a bird, which would be any breed, that is intentionally reared and trained for use in cockfight. And then if you go down to the definition of the crime of cockfighting, then not only does the bird have to be intentionally reared and trained for that purpose, the person accused of the crime would have to knowingly own, possess, keep, rear, train, purchase, sell, or advertise, or otherwise offers a fighting bird. That gets you back to the definition.
Okay.
But the bird has to be intentionally raised, reared, and trained for that purpose, and then the person intentionally engages in those particular activities. So there has to be a basis of probable cause to believe, which means more likely than not, this person committed the crime of cockfighting, and that's the crime that they committed before you could ever get to that place. So the result being, if you have a bird that's being raised or reared for the purpose of using its feathers for fly tying, I guess it is, and other kinds of things that they might use them for, you'd have to have evidence, that would be contrary to the person's statement that I'm raising this bird for the following purpose. If there's other evidence that would prove that they're not, in fact, they're doing it for cockfighting, then they're in trouble. If, in fact, they are doing it for that specific legal purpose, then they're not in trouble. Counsel, did I do that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I couldn't have said it any better.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the sake of relations with my own family, I wanted to get that on the record.
Yeah. I think it's pretty clear that it does not include birds that are raised or reared for purpose other than cockfighting. And the intentional, I kind of looked at the language on line 15 where the person is engaged in the conduct knowingly, but the intentional language in the definition of fighting bird seems to be appropriate for me. So, but we are creating another crime in this bill too, and I want to...
Mr. Chairman, before you
yes.
off of
sure.
the line 15, if say that there was a fighting bird, a bird that was trained or reared to be a fighting bird, and then for whatever reason somebody decided to rescue that bird and currently owned that bird, what protections would there be for that person who might have actually rescued a fighting bird and maybe keep them as a pet?
That's an excellent question. Counsel, I'll defer to you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as a committee, your person commits a crime of cockfighting if the person knowingly owns, possesses, keeps, rears, trains, buys, or sells, advertises a fighting bird, and the person is not possessing the bird knowingly for the purposes
mm-hmm.
of fighting.
Well, but they could own a bird that... is a fighting bird.
Sure.
If they don't use for that purpose, and I just want to make sure that they wouldn't get wrapped up into that definition.
Mr. Chair.
Randy?
Senator Burdick?
In response to your concerns, I can tell you from an investigation standpoint, if we were looking at that issue, our concern would be the actual use of the bird, and we would look at the definition, and I would agree with counsel that it would be related to knowingly having the bird for the purpose of fighting. And so and I think any responsible law enforcement officer, if they received a concern that a person simply owned a bird that either had been trained or had previously been used for fighting, we would look at its actual use at that time by the current owner.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you came across a bird that perhaps had its natural spur cut off and was living in a location and there was no other evidence to indicate it was a fighting bird, then that would not be sufficient?
That's correct, Senator Burdick. We would not find sufficient evidence to support an allegation of a crime being committed.
And I think I've said this before, you know, even a confession of a defendant alone in and of itself is not sufficient to convict a person. You have to have other corroborating evidence that supports the confession. So you have a bird that has a particular characteristic, that is not going to be sufficient to even rise to the level of probable cause. It just is what it is. I mean, you have to have, under the totality of the circumstances, more likely than not. And that's a pretty high standard, and that's the probable cause basis. And then if you have someone who's ultimately charged with a crime, then you have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt to get the conviction. So it looks pretty tight to me.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know. I've just always kind of avoided this issue because it's so unpleasant. I mean, I know that it's been extensively written about. It just pains me to read it, so I don't know as much as I should about it. If birds are rescued from fighting operations, can they become pets, or are they just forever, do they have to be killed?
Senator Burdick, Chair, Senator Burdick, members of the committee, in response to that question, I think the most common practice, once a case is resolved and in the event that there is a guilty finding or, you know, whatever the resolution is, if the birds are ultimately permanently removed from the previous owner, the normal procedure is to have those birds euthanized. Birds of this type don't generally make good pets in the first place. Whether that would be automatic, I would say no. I mean, certainly from the Humane Society standpoint, if we could find people that would be willing to take the birds and provide a place for them to live, continue to live, then, you know, we would certainly be willing to consider that as opposed to euthanasia. The difficulty with fighting birds is that when they are raised and trained for that purpose, you essentially need to keep them separate from other birds for the remainder of their life. And that's why when you find a cockfighting operation, you find that the cocks are all tethered out individually, because left to mingle amongst themselves, they will fight and they will cause injuries on their own, because that's what they've been raised and trained to do. So I won't say that it would automatically be euthanized, but that's normally the most practical and humane way to deal with birds that have been seized.
Chairman, Senator Burdick, this bill also provides the judge to make that ruling, so the choice would either be to humanely euthanize them or put them perhaps in a home in a situation where they were, you know, rescued. But they do tend to be aggressive at that point.
All right, let's talk about Section 7 of the bill, because we're creating a crime of forcible recovery of a fighting bird, and give us some background on why we're doing that. Is there some belief that once a bird is taken into...
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, my understanding of reading this bill, and I actually... really support that particular section. Parts of the bill talk about constructive possession of the birds, which in the course of an investigation, the birds essentially become evidence of the crime of cockfighting.
Right.
And the bill makes provisions to keep the birds on the property where they were seized, and actually allows the bird owner to continue providing care. This section of the bill essentially my understanding is that it protects the evidence in the case and is intended to punish people that might try to dispose of the evidence or otherwise interfere with the proper disposition of the investigation.
So tell me, what's envisioned here? I'm looking at the definition. Constructive possession means an exercise of dominion or control over the location and treatment of property without taking physical possession of the property. So, assumedly, you might have a location where these birds would be. There's a basis, probable cause to believe that they're, in fact, cockfighting birds. You somehow tag the bird or you do something and you, in essence, wave your hand over and said, I'm taking, you know, possession, constructive possession of these birds. And then there's a duty on behalf of the person who's caring for the bird to not do something or help me understand what we're doing. You leave the birds at the site, basically, and tell them this is a fighting bird and, oh, by the way, you're going to be indicted and blah, blah, blah. Take care of the birds, and then you're going to leave.
I think that's the very simplified version. I think I don't know that it's any more complex than that. It's simply a mechanism to allow investigators, police officers, to maintain possession, constructive possession, meaning essentially they're under the control.
But they can't turn around and destroy the evidence, so to speak. They can't
turn around and destroy it. They would be required to go through some sort of court action or go before a judge to make any changes to the location and the keeping of the birds.
Right.
The reason that this particular section is important is because one of the biggest issues in any animal welfare investigation, if you're talking about a seizure, is housing of those animals until the case until a final resolution is reached in the case. We've certainly seen more than one occasion where a case can go 1 or 2 years before it's resolved. And animals aren't like cars or motorcycles or other pieces of evidence from other types of crimes that you can just put in an evidence locker and have them sit there. They need ongoing care. This particular section allows for that care to be provided without in an area where the animals are already comfortable being. There's already facilities there for them to be cared for, and the owner is also paying the bill and the responsibility is on them. Mm-hmm. So again, it doesn't interfere with anything that they want to do in terms of keeping the animals healthy. And ongoing care, it simply prevents them from removing the animals and essentially destroying or hiding evidence related to the case.
Senator Starr, did you have a comment? I'm not sure if I caught it. No comment. Okay. Well, this seems kind of odd to me, a little strange, that you're going to leave evidence at a location. It just seems kind of silly. How many birds would we be talking about? I mean,
you know, it can certainly be as few as 5 or 10 and as many as 100 to a couple of hundred or even more. I think on average we're talking 50 to 100, maybe 150 birds, so it's quite a few. It would be overwhelming for any investigative agency to try to take those birds elsewhere and provide care for them.
Chairman, this section was added or clarified last session. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association really advocated for this because, again, they didn't have the ability to house them and they didn't know where they would if this turned up. And also they wanted the responsibility of the financial responsibility to be put on the owner. And I know that I've looked at the reports in the media, if I've looked at the different raids, usually is on average of about 50 to 100 fighting birds that law enforcement come upon, and that's over the last couple of years.
I would also like to add that I certainly understand your concern about leaving evidence on scene. One of the things that is also different from animals in regards to other types of evidence is that the real value of the animal in terms of evidence in an animal welfare investigation is at the time of the investigation. And generally it's related to, well, not always, but generally it's related to the condition of the animal at the time of the seizure.
Right.
As you provide good care, and in the case of a cockfighting investigation, you might be looking at birds that have injuries and things that are going to heal over time. So their value as evidence actually diminishes rather quickly after the initial investigation and seizure.
Right. I guess I'm trying to figure this out. If I were in your position and I had a probable cause basis to believe that somebody's doing the following, clearly you're not going to take the person into custody and arrest them or book them, because if you do and they stay in jail, who's going to care for the birds? I mean, would you give the responsibility to the person's wife or some other caretaker? I guess I don't understand exactly how this works, because you're going to charge them with a crime. You're either going to put them in jail or not. You're going to, you know, take photographs, fingerprints, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and depending on the circumstance, you may keep the person in jail. So if you do that, who is responsible? Who's the person who now becomes responsible for these birds? And what if they don't want to or didn't have or play a role in the activity to begin with? It seems to me to be rather silly to tell, you know, some other third party that, oh, by the way, you're now responsible for these birds and don't dispossess or sell, et cetera, et cetera. Does that make any sense?
It does, and I certainly have had those same thoughts myself, being involved in these types of investigations. I don't read anything in this bill that would prohibit the decision being made to go ahead and take those birds and do something else with them. I think it simply allows constructive possession as an option.
But again, I'm envisioning myself in this role as a law enforcement officer, and I say, okay, I'm now waving my wand here and saying that I'm declaring we have constructive possession, and then I do what I'm doing. And then I arrest the guy, and now who's the person that is subject? I don't understand who that person would be if I've actually arrested the responsible party.
It's a good question. I think one of the things that we find is that there's generally more than one person on the property, and the people that own the birds would prefer to make arrangements to have them cared for there, under the assumption that they are innocent until proven guilty, and that they have the opportunity to provide care. And so even if they're in jail, they will take steps to make sure their birds are properly cared for. If they don't, then the investigative agency is ultimately responsible for the bird's care and can either have somebody stop by the property and provide the care, which would still allow for those facilities to be used, or can make other decisions. I understand your concerns, and I think that this bill allows for several options.
Mm-hmm. I would be more comfortable if counsel help me if I'm going down a dead end here or something, but if the person or a person would be an owner, possessor, or keeper, which is the language that appears in Section 6, does the following things. Because, I mean, assumedly the owner is going to go to jail. I mean, all of these people could actually go to jail if they're engaged in the activity. But if you did take the constructive possession and then assign, and once you declare that, then an owner, possessor, or keeper, and I'm thinking that if somebody agrees at the time that we're going to take care of the birds, we want the birds here, and I think that's what you're trying to say, we want to keep the birds here, we're going to care for them, is that okay? You say that's fine, you're now an owner, possessor, or keeper, and you have a duty to not dispossess, et cetera, et cetera. And if you do dispossess, then you're going to be subject to potential criminal penalties. Counsel, help me with this.
Sure. I think you've got a point here, and I think there's a disconnect between Section 6 and Section 7, because it could be any person who can come along and forcibly removes a bird, but above it raises some interesting issues. And that is, I assume that you need the birds at the time of trial, right?
The birds themselves?
Yes. For the case?
Generally, either the birds or photos of the birds.
So, what and you are now charging with someone with providing all the necessary care for the bird. If someone doesn't care for the bird and it takes a year for the trial, there aren't going to be any birds around, am I correct?
Right.
And there's no penalty for that.
Well, the penalty for that would be somebody that's responsible for the birds fails to provide care. That would be a neglect issue. And technically, then we could look at it from the standpoint of neglect. But ultimately, if the birds are seized, it's just like somebody that's incarcerated. They become the responsibility of the agency that has initiated the seizure. So if somebody's not providing care, for example, if the Oregon Humane Society was conducting the investigation, we seized birds, we identified somebody as a responsible party to provide care, they agreed to, we would be responsible for following up and making sure that the birds were properly cared for. It would be in our interest as the investigating agency to make sure that our evidence is maintained properly for the case.
So if you have constructive possession over the birds, and I'm no longer responsible for care and maintenance?
Your interest in providing care and maintenance would be in hopes that you would ultimately retain ownership and you would still have your birds in good health. What this section does is it tries to relieve the burden on investigative agencies on providing very expensive care for animals related to an investigation. It also allows the animal owners to provide care as they see fit, as long as it maintains the health of the birds.
I think the question that we need to ask is, what do you actually have to have the bird as evidence? Or would videotape and photographs and other...
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is no. You don't actually have to have the bird. As I mentioned earlier, the evidentiary value of the birds diminishes rather quickly after the seizure, and so it's the photos of the birds at the time of the investigation that really become important. The reason for keeping the birds is because we don't want to release them and have them go back into being used for cockfighting elsewhere. So ultimately, the goal is to have the birds as evidence. The person who's being investigated have their ownership terminated. That doesn't happen until the case is resolved, although we would also at the same time be looking at the animal forfeiture law. There have been some questions about that through the legislative process, but we would be looking at forfeiture. So it wouldn't necessarily be that these birds would be sitting on this property cared for by the owner or a designee for the 1 or 2 years that it may take the case to be resolved. We would be pursuing other avenues that are already in law that would allow for a disposition of the animals prior to resolution of the case. But this bill allows for a way to provide, a reasonable way to continue to provide care for the cocks during the investigation and pending other.
Yeah, so you have a couple of issues here. One is having sufficient evidence to be available at trial to support the allegation. So you might seize 1 out of 10 animals, take custody of that animal. It just seems to me that the state should be caring for the evidence, not the defendant.
That certainly is the natural feeling. I mean, those of us have gone through law enforcement training, and we do these things, and we seize evidence. That's what we like to do. We like to seize the evidence, to keep it in our possession. We don't want anybody else to have control. And so I agree, and I certainly understand where you're coming from in this feeling odd in terms of seizing evidence and yet leaving it there for basically the suspect.
I'm just wondering what a judge is going to do with this.
Well, I guess what I would like to do is pass the bill and find out.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's nice, except I got to tell you, I think this section is sloppily written, and I'm not comfortable with that section of the bill.
Chair Menace?
Yes.
One of the things that I've seen a lot of times is that you come up with a law and you try to make it as practical from an administration standpoint as possible. And I've seen in years gone by where we've had civil forfeiture situations where we wind up with livestock or other situations where the care becomes the overriding issue, because the longevity of a lot of these cases isn't a matter of weeks, it's a matter of sometimes a year. So I think from a practicality standpoint, what we're trying to accomplish here is kind of the best of a bad situation, and that's the practical care of these animals until the situation can be resolved judicially.
I would agree with you if we weren't creating another crime. And I think Section 6 might be functional, and there are other, you know, potential criminal penalties for destruction of evidence or tampering with witnesses and other kinds of different things that are already available in statute. Just the idea that a person, any person literally, would commit by doing, knowingly dispossessing or knowingly attempts to dispossess a law enforcement agency, I don't get it. I don't understand what we're doing here. It seems to compound the problem. I think what you want to be able to do is allow the birds to stay there and have someone care for them, and you don't want them destroyed or you know, moved out of. Wouldn't it be possible to get a court order to direct the person to take care of the birds? And
Chairman, sort of members of the committee, I think as I read this, the constructive possession is simply for the first 24 hours, and then a court order is, you are required to get a court order to continue that. Also, I do see a connection between Section 6 and Section 7 in that, first of all, I think you're right, Senator Minnis, that there are other laws that deal with tampering with evidence. But the connection here is that it makes it very clear right up front to the person responsible for providing care that the responsibility they're taking on is to provide care, and they cannot do anything with that evidence. It ties Section 6 directly to a penalty if this particular evidence is removed or sold or otherwise disposed of.
Well, actually, I think that the 24-hour period, that actually is helpful, because assumedly you have to go get a court order.
Yeah, and I apologize. I didn't make that clear initially, that in my testimony I did state that it does require quick action to show probable cause within 24 hours of constructive possession.
All right. And then we're going to serve on this person a court order. Interesting. Just I'm trying to figure out what kind of affidavit you're going to prepare. Are you going to prepare an affidavit like a search warrant, in essence, stating the facts and location, et cetera, take it to judge and ask the judge to issue a court order compelling this person to do the following?
That's my understanding in reading the bill. It is somewhat new language. I mean, it certainly is a departure from what we normally accept as a standard procedure for dealing with these,
all right,
you know, evidentiary issues.
And that gets back to Section 4, where it talks about the judge may order the bird impounded on the property, blah, blah, blah. So.
Yes, sir.
All right. Any other questions? I did have the folks, and they're not here today, interestingly, who have problems with the bill, come to me with some language on a task force dealing with, and I think it gets back to this Newcastle disease issue, and I think the fear that somehow birds, just any particular breeds of birds, might be caught up in this situation. They wanted amendments in this bill to deal with the task force dealing with birds. It is not my desire to put that amendment in this particular bill, but I do want to continue to engage y'all in a discussion to add task force language in another bill, which is one of the reasons I held some of the other things up yesterday. So. Any other questions on this bill? There are no questions. Desire of the committee?
Well, Mr. Chair, I heard hours of testimony on this bill last session in the House Judiciary Committee. Saw all the tools that they use and all the pictures and heard all the arguments, and I was convinced then and I'm convinced now that cockfighting is a bad thing and we need to do something about it.
All right. work session. House Bill 2086, Aiden Gross. Madam Vice Chair.
I enthusiastically move House Bill 2086 to the Senate floor with a brief passage.
Okay. Senator Burke moves House Bill 2086, Aiden Gross, to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? There's no objection to the motion. Motion passes. And I will carry the, bill. I think that's all the business before the committee, and we're now adjourned. Yeah, I want to.